Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 20th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, teenagers on deadline. Meta issues a warning to teens facing being cut off by the government's social media ban. And move over Albo, the ARIA winners who stole last night's award show.
New Prime Minister of Australia. I would like to say all immigrants welcome. I'd like to say land back. Thank you. What a massive night. What a crazy time. This album's really changed all of our lives. Like, oh my God.
And the winner is Turquia. Adelaide will miss out on hosting the COP31 climate change meeting under a deal in which Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen will take on the COP presidency. The Pacific will also host a climate meeting with global leaders ahead of the main COP gathering. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says it's a good result.
We're very pleased with the outcome. Turquia will host the conference, but Australia, by having the COP presidency for negotiations, will be in a very strong position, and some might argue in the strongest possible position.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, speaking a short time ago. Well, Richie Mersian is a former Australian government climate negotiator who's been in Brazil for COP30. He's also the CEO of the Clean Energy Investor Group. He joined me earlier. Richie Mersian, welcome to The World Today.
Good to be with you.
What does it mean for Australia to concede that Adelaide is not going to host COP31 and that Turquia, in fact, will?
It is not the outcome that the Australian government wanted. Adelaide is the perfect backdrop. It's at 74% renewables. It is living the transition. It'll be the first time we would have hosted in the UN history in the climate world. Unfortunately, the way things have unfolded, it made it quite hard for the delegation here on the ground. And they've had to concede this second best option, which is that Turkey hosts, but Australia still plays a role.
And in fact, that role will be Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen assuming the COP presidency. How important and key is that role to Australia's climate ambitions and, I suppose, policy direction?
Just to be clear, I'm not sure he'll actually officially be the COP president. I know he'll have certainly a fair bit of responsibility and he'll be given similar status to a president, but officially Turkey would hold it. What it does mean, hopefully, and we're still teasing this all out, is that he would be able to shape the agenda. He would be able to come up with some of the big initiatives that could really leverage what Australia's been doing on clean energy, on home electrification, on green exports, green iron. So there's still a lot there that he can bring to the fold. Plus, there'll probably be a big meeting in the lead up to the COP in the Pacific that Australia and the Pacific will help shape as well. So there's still some pieces that Australia will exercise, even though it's not the outcome that we're looking for.
The ABC's reporting that Australia had been canvassing the deal with Pacific leaders over the last 2 days to host this lead-up meeting before the main COP gathering. Will Pacific Island nations be disappointed too?
Look, this is second best. I mean, the whole goal of this was to bring this whole event to our region. We've had three of these COPs in the Middle East and North Africa, and now the reality is we'll have a fourth. And so is this the outcome the Pacific wanted? Will they be able to bring the same kind of representation and pressure? I'm not sure. So I think this is not what they were hoping for, but it's still something. And we'll still be able to bring everyone to the Pacific for a preparatory meeting, a pre-COP, which will still be an important part of the picture.
The cost of hosting COP is not insignificant. Some numbers have been bandied around to the tune of $2 billion, although Foreign Minister Penny Wong sort of dodged that question when asked. I mean, are we saving money by not hosting this conference and still getting some seat at the table with Chris Bowen's assumption as COP president?
I mean, if you look at it in the raw numbers, you can say we're not going to be putting on a major event, but that was the whole part of it, right? You got to spend to make money. This was going to be the world's largest trade show on climate solutions. This is the opportunity for Australia to showcase everything it's doing. It's worth remembering 70% of the investment into Australia for renewables comes from overseas. We need foreign investment to build a net zero economy. So this was definitely going to have a significant return on investment to host. And South Australia was willing to put that forward, to put its hand up to make that happen. So I think seeing it through a narrow frame of this will cost a little bit of money, was a real poor construct. This is an investment like any major undertaking in Australia's future, and that's what we had on the table. Unfortunately, that's not happening, so let's see what we can do with what we've got left.
Richie Merzian, I do appreciate you joining me on the way back from Brazil. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Richie Merzian is a former Australian government climate negotiator. He's now the CEO of the Clean Energy Investor Group. Social media giant Meta has begun sending two-week warnings to teenagers under the age of 16, urging them to download or delete their account data from Facebook and Instagram. Australia's social media ban begins in less than a month, but Meta says they'll begin removing access for teens as early as December 4. Many parents are bracing for how their children will react to the change as they scramble to get and save their information before the lockout period. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
The move to get teenagers to switch off is already underway. Tech giant Meta sending notifications to all young social media account holders from today, giving them 14 days to save their memories before they're locked out of their accounts on December 10. Brittany Fontana says her 14-year-old daughter has been in panic mode.
My daughter has come home and told me, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. They're taking away all of our rights to human interaction.
The regional Victorian mother says her daughter and her friends have begun counting down the days.
They've been constantly in group chats and calls to discuss anything and everything because they believe it's going to be the last time they can speak to each other in the longest time. So it's a very doomsday panic among teenage girls. They will be fine. They will actually see each other at school the next day.
The federal government passed legislation earlier this year banning children under 16 from having accounts on a range of social media platforms in an effort to protect them from online harms, including sexual abuse, deepfake abuse material, violence and cyberbullying.
I think it will be really inconvenient for kids, particularly if they're in rural areas, for example, and they're heavily reliant on digital platforms to stay in contact with their friends.
Dr. Belinda Barnett is a social media expert at Swinburne University of Technology. She supports the ban, but worries about the initial impact for those who grew up in the digital era.
What I would be advising them is over the next couple of weeks to find an alternative way to keep in contact with their friends. So it's not like they're being shut off from the entire internet. Kids can set up WhatsApp groups, for example, with their friends.
Dr. Barnett says Meta giving teenagers time to prepare for the deadline is a good idea.
It's just saying, look, you're going to need to transition to an alternative way of keeping in contact with friends after this point, and you can come back to your account when you're 16. But in the meantime, this is what you're going to need to do.
Dr. Hannah Jarman is a research fellow at Deakin University School of Psychology. She says the weeks and months after the ban are going to be crucial for researchers.
I'm sure that there will be some who benefit from this. There will also be a significant amount that I think could struggle with this. And I think for parents, we need to just have really open conversations with young people, being really empathetic and acknowledging and validating some of their concerns, which are likely going to be really prevalent.
Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, has been a big advocate for the ban aimed at protecting young people. Earlier this week, she successfully pushed for online gaming company Roblox to introduce age verification technology to help protect children in chat rooms, claiming it was becoming a playground for pedophiles. She's now been asked to testify before a US congressional committee over concerns she's harming Americans' free speech, a request the eSafety Commissioner says she's now considering. Meanwhile, other parents like Felicity Clissold suspect their teenagers will now be looking for ways to get around the ban.
She's got a year to go, year and a half, and she's just going to continue on the ones that she's able to. And if not, she'll find another way of getting on.
Parent Felicity Clissold sending that report by Kathleen O'Connor and Julia Bergen. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Your dream home just sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars more than what you were told on inspection. Well, does that sound familiar? Underquoting, leading to bitter disappointment for home buyers, is being tackled under proposed first-of-its-kind laws in one state. Real estate agents will be forced to publish the reserve price at least a week out from an auction. The question is, who'll be responsible for enforcement. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
If you've ever gone to an auction and realised the price guide is well below what the vendor wanted to sell for, that's what's known as underquoting. Nick Stakos is Victoria's Minister for Consumer Affairs.
It's an unethical practice. It's a dishonest practice. It is widely understood, I think, by the community, including many real estate agents, that it is inherently unfair.
Underquoting can happen when a property's advertised at a price that's less than the estimated selling price or less than the reserve, which is the seller's asking price. Nick Stakos says the Victorian government wants to stamp it out, with a proposed bill set to be introduced next year that would mandate the disclosure of the reserve price at least 7 days ahead of an auction.
You want people at an auction who can actually afford to buy your property. And I think the tragic thing about underquoting is it's often young prospective first home buyers who are the victims of it, because they're lured into a sales campaign and often they've spent money on pest inspections and building inspections, and all along they couldn't afford the property in the first place.
But industry representatives say publishing the reserve price is the wrong decision. Toby Ballage is the chief executive of the Real Estate Institute of Victoria.
There's ways in which we can bring greater price transparency to the market, and as an institute and our members, we fully support that. But we need to balance that with the rights of vendors to maximise their sale price.
Mr. Ballage says the industry acknowledges it's frustrating for buyers when the vendor's reserve is significantly higher than the advertised price. But he says the industry is currently preparing to release its own recommendations on how to address underquoting, and he doesn't agree the government's plan will solve the problem.
But just saying that vendors must disclose their price 7 days prior to auction, it doesn't strike that balance between buyers having the right to, you know, getting an understanding of what the property will go for and vendors being able to, you know, work out where the market's at and set their price accordingly.
If passed, the proposed Victorian laws would be an Australian first. Buyer's agent Amy Linardi says she can't see how the laws would work in practice.
At the end of the day, the reserve price can often change throughout a property campaign depending on the number of buyers, depending on what's happening in the market at that point in time. How are they going to be able to communicate that? For example, if a vendor does change their mind just before an auction or just even during an auction.
In Victoria, real estate agents are already required to provide a statement of information which indicates a price and includes comparable sales. But Amy Linardi says while many agents are compliant, others can cherry-pick information or leave things out. She says rather than new laws, she'd like to see stricter enforcement on those in the industry that are deliberately misleading on price.
There's a culture and there's a way that agents speak to vendors around either not directly asking them, and that's a way that they can tend to circumvent the current legislation too. So more compliance around how that gets communicated during an auction campaign and then how that gets documented and therefore then how that could be audited later on. I think there's a way to explore it that way.
Buyer's agent Amy Linardi ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. A rural town on the New South Wales mid-north coast will be home to a state-first trial next year, offering mental health treatments to patients in their own homes. But residents and experts are worried the pilot program might undermine funding for inpatient services at the local hospital. Charles Rushforth reports.
In the rural town of Kempsey on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, mental health access is getting an overhaul.
A part of the recent redesign that we've been discussing is around the HIS model, which is a hospital in the home model for mental health services.
That's Sarah Fox, the head of mental health services at the Mid-North Coast Local Health District. She says from early next year, the town of 31,000 people will be able to access mental health treatment from their living rooms, with doctors travelling to patients' homes in a state-first trial.
This is a positive innovation for New South Wales Health, and we have the opportunity to be a leader across the state with developing a pilot for the Kempsey area. This is something that's been in the physical health space for the past 20 years and allows us to reduce stigma and provide more safe care in the comfort of people's home.
But the new model has been criticised by local residents because it means the mental health unit at the local hospital will no longer take patients.
I'm disappointed, I'm offended, I'm shocked, I'm saddened.
Alexandra Wyatt is a counsellor with Kempsey Shire Council. She says friends and family members have received life-saving care at the hospital's mental health unit.
It has offered them respite. It has offered them a place to sort of, you know, calm down, to breathe, to be connected with a social worker or a mental health nurse. It allows them to have a good night's sleep, to have a good meal, to not have to deal with whatever is going on at home or out in the community for them.
Councillor Wyatt says she's concerned treatment at home will be riskier than what's available at hospital because it doesn't give patients a chance to move to a neutral environment.
When my family was going through our experience with ill mental health, in the early 2000s, it was a stigma that I would never, ever put my hand up and talk about because it was uncomfortable and shameful. But since then, I have used my voice to advocate for change. And what I see in front of me, moving to an in-home hospital bed care situation, I think that's actually high risk. I mean, I'm not a practitioner, but I think that's high risk. And I also feel that in our situation, most likely that could have resulted in a death.
In a statement, the Mid-North Coast Local Health District said patient capacity will be increased at Port Macquarie Base Hospital's mental health unit, 55 kilometres away. The new pilot will also see more funding for community services, including programs aimed at First Nations mental health patients in the town, where 12% of the population is Indigenous. Hospital and the Home mental health care has already been rolled out in other states like Victoria and Tasmania, where experts say it's working well. Psychiatrist Patrick McGorry runs a clinic that offers the service in Melbourne.
Hospital and Home is an essential, I would say, adjunct for, you know, residential inpatient care, because it allows quite a few patients who otherwise would need to be admitted to hospital for treatment and for safety reasons to be treated in the home, and patients and families generally prefer that to going into an acute hospital unit.
New South Wales Minister for Mental Health Rose Jackson says if successful, the program could be rolled out statewide.
Charles Rushforth there. Overseas now, and tensions are growing in Europe as Russia continues to strike an aggressive stance over the war in Ukraine. In the latest provocation, the UK says a Russian spy ship operating on the edge of its maritime borders has used lasers to disrupt Air Force pilots monitoring its activities while gathering electronic intelligence and, it's believed, mapping crucial undersea cables. It comes as Russia launched hundreds of fresh drone and missile attacks in Ukraine, killing at least 25 people. Nick Grimm has the story.
Western analysts say the Russian vessel, the Yanta, is designed to gather intelligence and map the undersea infrastructure critical to island nations like Britain. Tom Sharp is a retired Royal Navy commander.
They are designed to spy, to conduct intelligence gathering operations, and you can do that in any number of ways. The most obvious one is they sit above our cables and our critical undersea infrastructure. And they nose around in the cables that transfer up to $7 trillion worth of financial interactions every day between us and America alone.
The Yanta operates out of the Arctic port of Murmansk and carries on board miniature remotely piloted submarines capable of diving to thousands of metres. And as it lurks outside Britain's territorial waters north of Scotland, the nation's military is preparing to take action if it ventures further south. But the Russian spy ship has already raised the stakes. John Healey is the UK Defence Secretary.
We deployed a Royal Navy frigate and RAF P-8 planes to monitor and track this vessel's every move, during which the Yanta directed lasers at our pilots. That Russian action is deeply dangerous.
It comes as Russia continues to probe weaknesses in the resolve of NATO nations as the war in Ukraine drags on. Overnight, Russia launched fresh attacks on Western Ukraine, hundreds of drones and missiles falling across the region, targeting energy and other infrastructure, but also residential areas. Locals able to do little but watch on as rescue workers attempted to free the injured and the dead.
We heard the explosion. We live on the first floor. We heard the explosions and everyone jumped out through the window. Our building, our apartment, is all filled with smoke.
My brother is still here on the ninth floor. We don't know where he is or what has happened to him.
In nearby Poland, thousands of troops have been mobilised to protect infrastructure in the wake of a railway explosion being blamed on Russian-linked saboteurs. The country also closing the last Russian consulate still operating in Poland. The Polish Army's Chief of General Staff, General Wacław Kukula, saying the country must prepare for further acts of sabotage.
We live in a time when we must devote significantly more attention to security. In just over a month, the Christmas holidays will begin, a period during which most Poles will travel by public transport. This calendar window could be perceived by our enemies as the most opportune time to attack our security.
It comes amid reports the Trump administration is working behind the scenes with Russia on a peace plan that would see Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told he must give up territory and weapons as part of the deal. Jim Townsend is a former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defence who spent more than two decades working on European and NATO policy in the Pentagon. The now adjunct senior fellow with the US think tank, the Center for a New American Security, believes the deal will be a difficult one for Ukraine and its European allies to accept.
Well, it's a tremendous concession. This is something that could topple Zelensky. This is something that could cause maybe a pause in the fighting, but it will pick it back up as the Russians want more. I mean, this is more like, you know, 1938 in Czechoslovakia, you know, where the Sudetenland was given to Hitler to appease him. And of course, Hitler came back for more. So the history of this is not a very good sign. So I think we're going to find that this is going to be something that Zelensky is going to have to swallow. He had better get something pretty big in return, and I'm not sure what that is.
Jim Townsend from the Center for a New American Security. Ending that report by Nick Grimm. It's Aussie music's night of nights, with yet another year of music celebrated at the 2025 ARIA Awards last night. While there was something to suit every musical taste, it was a night dominated by female Australian artists and punk rockers, Amyl and the Sniffers, who led the charge. Here's Luke Radford.
Fresh off a world tour and shutting down Melbourne's Victoria Square last week, Amyl and the Sniffers walked into the ARIA Awards last night at the peak of their powers. With gongs for Best Group, Best Rock Album and Best Cover Art already in the bag, the band also took out Album of the Year for Cartoon Darkness. And as always, it was the tongue-in-cheek but politically charged frontwoman Amy Taylor who stole the show.
As the new Prime Minister of Australia, I would like to say all immigrants welcome. I'd like to say land back. Thank you, what a massive night, what a crazy time. This album's really changed all of our lives, like, oh my God.
On a night dominated by the pub rockers, it was the female artists who took over. Central Coast electronic artist and DJ Nena Jirachi claimed three awards, including Best Solo Artist. And Western Sydney rapper Barker overcame heavyweights Hilltop Hoods and Kid Laroi to take out Best Hip Hop Track.
I just want to thank the mob and always the mob. I'm proud. Thank the mob back home, Barkindji people. Thank black fellas in the building. This is for the mob, man. And the house is so
damn quiet when you... Missy Higgins turned the clock back 20 years, taking out the Best Adult Contemporary Album for the second act and dedicating her win to Single Mums.
This album, you may have guessed by that song, is about my divorce a few years ago and becoming a single mum. Being a 42-year-old woman and singing about divorce and single parenting isn't like the sexiest thing you can do in this industry.
But while it was a night of celebration, it comes at a challenging time for Australian music. The number of Australian artists on the local charts has plummeted in recent years. Double J's music and pop culture reporter Al Newstead says while some bands have cut through, it's not been easy.
I think locally there is a challenge, particularly on the ARIA charts, about cut through and people reaching Australian music. I think it's exciting. I agree that there's so much great stuff happening, but it's challenging in that, you know, it's not always getting visible eyeballs.
But with Amyl and the Sniffers taking the world and the awards by storm, the night held another big question. Is rock and roll back?
This kind of convo happens all the time, right? It's like rock's dead, rock's gone away, rock's come back. I don't know if I really play into that per se. I think it's probably, you know, they in particular are having a big moment, especially internationally. We know that, you know, there's cycles every 5 or 10 years where the UK and America, they really like to be like, oh, this is the hot new thing from Australia. And right now, yeah, it's pub punk. It's Amyl and the Sniffers, but it could be something else.
But on a night that celebrated the new generation, it was capped off with a love letter to the old, as legendary rockers UMI were inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame.
That makes me feel old. UMI in the Hall of Fame. Very good. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump resisted it for so long, but after a massive U-turn earlier this week, the remaining Epstein files are set to be released. The US House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted in favour of a bill to force the release of the documents. Today, David A. Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, on how Trump was backed into a corner. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.